Just before we move on to our next guest, a Dublin man has been sentenced to 5.5 years for the armed robbery of an estimated €50,000 from a security van driver outside AIB Bank in Clane back in 2019. With more on this story, here's Caoimhe Hearney. Caoimhe.
Yeah, so 36-year-old Graham Doyle from Finglas pleaded guilty at a sitting of Naas District Court, Criminal Court to the robbery outside the AIB branch at Main Street in Clane back in May, on the 30th of May 2019. Garda evidence was that Doyle, holding a gun, approached the driver of a security van making a cash delivery to the branch at around 2 p.m. on the day. Garda say neither the gun nor the money were recovered. The court was told that Doyle ran up the main street, then climbed over a 10-foot wall near Manser's pub and escaped in a transit van. The van was later found out. Burned out 2 days later.
Yeah, you can get more on that story on our website www.kfmradio.com for that and more local stories, including what we heard in the news there at 10 o'clock, that 7 new speed cameras will go live in Kildare. Nationwide, 61 new speed cameras will go live this morning as Gardaí and the Road Safety Authority encourage drivers to lower their speed. The cameras are spread around 23 counties, with the majority on regional and national routes, including here in Kildare, and we have a full list of the maps of where those speed cameras will be located. KFMradio.com.
Have your say now. Text or WhatsApp Kildare today on 0833 97 97 97.
Well, it was announced last week that teenagers will be taught about porn as part of the new Junior Cert syllabus. Education Minister Norma Foley announced a major revamp of the way sex is set to be taught to children in secondary schools. The course hasn't changed in over 20 years, with Minister Foley saying that change is needed because the course is, in quotes, outdated. On the line now is Dr. Siobhan O'Higgins, Research Fellow at NUIG's School of Psychology and also on the NCCA Development Group working on this new curriculum. Dr. O'Higgins, good morning and welcome to the programme.
Good morning and thank you, Owen. Thank you for having me.
So the NCCA is the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment, and it has completed a review of the way sex is taught in our schools and have come up with a major overhaul of relationships and sexuality education. Tell us more about the overview here of what could be taught in schools.
Well, basically, it's an overview of the whole social, personal and health education curriculum. So it includes everything. It's not just RSE, the relationships and sexuality education. It's the whole SPHE program, which is now going to be embedded in a wellbeing program for all of our children, which is going to cover about 400 hours a year for each child, wherever they are in the junior cycle and eventually be the senior cycle. So it's going to ensure that they have more of an understanding of the positive things about growing up, about forming relationships, intimacy, about the things that they're seeing, all of this. And everybody's got sort of very exorcised about the whole idea that they're going to be looking at porn or understanding porn. What it's going to be is about giving them critical thinking about what they're seeing, so that they learn to think twice about the things that they're seeing in relation to the sexual media that they're engaging with, and to ask what is really going on in the world instead of accepting all of these images, which are actually making our children feel very insecure and very vulnerable. So it's about making sure that they can see through what they're seeing in terms of their social media, in terms of the people that they're following, in terms of all of these things, so that they can start to analyse what they're actually being told and to see more clearly. And so, yeah, so it's about reducing the vulnerability of our young people, because RSE, as you say, hasn't been revised for decades, and it needs to be revised and brought up to date, and to actually look at the context in which our young people are exploring their sexuality. And it's very different from the context in which I definitely, when I was a teenager. So it's about us looking at how we can give them the information they need to make informed choices to actually reduce their vulnerability, because we know from all the research that's been going on around the place that there's a lot of sexual abuse, sexual harassment, and even down to children being abused by their peers. So that's not okay. So how do we educate our children to know what's okay and what's not okay? And it's very difficult when you're a teenager, because you don't know what's okay and what's not okay. You know, you accept an awful lot of things which actually are abusive if you were better informed, you could actually call it out and say, no, that's not okay. I'm not going to do that. No, you can't do that. No, you can't say that. All of those kind of things. So it's a really important revamp. It's absolutely fantastic that the NCCA are doing this, and they've engaged with everybody. They've engaged with parents, with children, with teachers, with everybody to find out what the issues were. And then they've worked tirelessly with different developmental groups. I'm on the one developmental group, but there's another developmental group for looking at the curriculum for primary school children, and there'll be another one for looking at the senior cycle. And I'm involved, I'm one of the co-leads on the Active Consent Programme, and we're creating resources based on data that we get from doing research that will explore the issues of consent and also looking at sex on our screens. That's a new e-learning resource that we've developed based on data from young people and parents as to what are the issues and what they need to know factually.
It's interesting that you say that, you know, the way people learn now and talk about sexuality and sexual relations has changed than when you were in school, because there was that word stigma around it, and nothing changes if nothing changes. So it raises the question, do you think maybe this is actually a little bit late? Should we have done this earlier? But at least now it's being done and it's the right time.
Yeah, well, we could say it should have been done earlier, but to actually do a revamp like this is a very timely business, and you have to do it properly. You know, there's no point in doing tweaking changes. And we know from around the country that a lot of teachers have accessed really good resources in order to educate the young people that they're working with. This is about streamlining so that every child has the access to the same information, instead of it being really good in some schools but not so good in other schools. So, you know, it's about making sure that we're, you know, that it's uniform across the country. Yeah. And that's what we found when anything that we've evaluated any of our resources on the Active Consent Programme is that young people say, this is great. Now everybody in the school, now everybody in this university has the same information. We're all starting from a higher level. We all understand what consensual intimacy might look like. We all understand what the law is. We all understand what we could say. All of those things. So young people really appreciate everybody getting the same information.
Yeah, and we're going to talk to Aileen Hickey from Parentline in a moment to get this from a parent's point of view, and she says that parents need not be concerned about the updated curriculum. And I know as well that the suggestions are out for public consultation, so parents and teachers and students, they can all have their say. But back to the issue of pornography, and you say that most young people admit that porn is not the same as reality, but they're unaware how it's influencing their brains, and it has impacts on a child's brain.
Well, it has many impacts on their self-esteem and their understanding of how to explore their sexuality. It has, for some young people, it can become addictive because it's the whole novelty of it, because you can see different things every time you go online. And it's not just about pornography. I think we need to move away from just saying that it's about porn. There is sexual media in everything that they're looking at. You know, if you look at TikTok, if you look at OnlyFans, if you look at Discord, if you look at all of these things that young people are engaging with and getting information from, they're all very sexualized. I mean, look at Love Island. I mean, what is the age group that are watching Love Island and enjoying it? You know, there's, you know, it's everywhere, and it's about giving our children the skills to be able to say, okay, so they're saying this. Actually, the script that they're actually telling me is that X should say Y, which isn't actually real. You know, that's not going to actually make sure that everybody is having a mutually enjoyable, mutually consensual and safe experience.
And I note as well, Dean MacDonald, who's a member of the Psychological Society of Ireland, warning that the proportion of boys and girls who are engaging in porn, or as you say, other forms of sexual media, is a lot more balanced than some people might think. A lot might think that this is just young lads who are in school that are, you know, curious or exploring their sexuality. But in fact, it's all teenagers, all young people are exposed to it.
Absolutely. And it's preteens as well. Working in primary schools, working with primary school children, you know, they're exposed to all sorts of things because, as you say, they're curious. And they're, you know, they're trying to get it right, and they don't know how to get it right. And it's about how do they find out the answers with that. So they Google it, and they come across all sorts of weird and wonderful or not so wonderful or quite scary things. And as parents, parents need to have the confidence to actually talk to their children about things like this that are not to threaten to take their phones away, because then their child will never actually ask them, look, I just saw this, what does this mean? You know, all of that. So we as parents, we need to take a breath and actually listen to our children and try and help them to navigate safely the online world, because they don't see the difference between online and offline, our young people, our children, you know, and it's a whole other world. The world before social media and the world after social media is completely different, you know, so it's about working with our children to protect them, really. Information is power.
Yeah, absolutely. And that leads us on perfectly into our next guest who's on the line. But for the moment, that is Dr. Siobhan O'Higgins, Research Fellow at NUIG's School of Psychology. She's also on the NCCA Development Group working on the new curriculum. Dr. O'Higgins, thanks for joining us. But Aileen Hickey, CEO of Parentline, also joins us this morning. Aileen, welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Owen.
So just to get your reaction and your view then on this curriculum change or the updated curriculum from a parent's point of view and perhaps the concerns the parents might have, you say parents need not be concerned about these changes.
It's definitely not. I mean, I think that you don't think any parent needs to panic, because I think, you know, I suppose maybe the word pornography, as it has appeared in a lot of the print media at this stage, might have sent the shivers down parents' back, but actually, you know, this new updated curriculum change is a very positive thing. I mean, first of all, there has been reform has been needed since it has been 20 years, I think, since that curriculum was looked at. And I think any parent would feel that, you know, it's very important to educate the minds of our children, our young people, about healthy relationships, and primarily, which is a huge issue for parents, about the issue of consent and about the issue of appropriate behaviour when they're online or on social media or on the internet or anything digital or anything like that. I mean, I think most parents are now of the view that they can't be blinkered and they can't keep their heads in the sand, because the reality is that the world our children and our young people are living in is very much a digital world with online access, online access very easy to get to, and access to social media. And the last thing you want your children and young people to have is the wrong information or misinformation. You know, I think parents want their children very much to have the correct information, and I think most parents understand that they need to give young people the tools in order to be able to navigate that world. Now, I will say, and as a parent myself, you know, these can be difficult subjects, and you know, they can be uncomfortable to talk about, but that doesn't mean that we can blink ourselves and not talk about them, because I think maybe the important thing is that we don't make our children either victims or perpetrators of any kind of sexual or sexual violence or sexual harassment or anything of that type. And in order to be able to do that, and if you want your child to make a good judgment, they need to be educated with as much information as possible so that they, to allow them to interact with others, you know, in a safe and a healthy way. Mm-hmm. And as I say, they need the skills to be able to do that, you know, and they need to be able to understand the risks and consequences, you know, of what they might be doing online, because, you know, obviously there are one of the concerns that we would have parents ring us fairly regularly about would be fears of their children sharing sexual images online or having sexual images shared with them online. So again, you know, that's all, you know, a world that just needs to be discussed, and communication, like everything else to do with parenting, communication is always going to be the key, and that's, you know, to do with talking and listening and teaching and trying to keep the doors of communication open, even when it is difficult and it can be a tricky enough topic to talk about.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you heard Siobhan O'Higgins a little bit earlier there, Aileen. She was saying that even when she was in school, the way sexual relations was taught would be completely different to how it's being taught now, and that would kind of be related to the parents as well. They'd be of the age group in their 40s, 50s, maybe 60s. They have children now in first, second or third year. They might be unsure how to breach the subject of sexuality and sexual relations to their children, but I'm sure the advice would be to break that barrier and, as you say, keep the lines of communication open and don't be afraid to have those discussions.
It's not just to be, you know, to ensure that your children are educated in this area and informed in this area, but to be informed in this area as a parent. Because again, as I say, you know, it's not something you can just stick your head in the sand and hope it'll go away, because, you know, the online world is very much there and it's very much part of our children and our young people's lives. And yes, you're right, you know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, I think, or even more recently, you know, it might have been that it was kind of, you know, well, hope the teacher might teach them a bit in school, or they might learn from their friends, or, you know, parents might stick a book under their pillow and hope that they'd get away with it like that. It certainly wasn't something that they wanted to discuss with their children. But I think, you know, maybe it wasn't as much in their faces as it is now, because, you know, I do think most parents, I think 9 out of 10 parents, I think, are figures that are concerned about their children's online activity. And a lot of that activity can be, you know, to do with, you know, not necessarily pornography, but can be, do, as I say, to do with sharing sexual images of, online, or it can be to do with just any sort of, you know, inappropriate activity online. So I think, you know, this is very important, because, as I say, you know, it's very much framed around we need to educate youthful minds, and, you know, to get them to learn about what is a healthy relationship. And as I say, you know, learning about consent is really important. Learning about appropriate behaviour is really important. And you don't want them to have the wrong information. And it's fantastic that this will be updated. And, you know, and also, you know, I suppose all the additional elements, because it's not just pornography, there is, you know, gender and sexual orientation, sexual health. There are a number of aspects of this proposed update that are really important for both the children and young people, and for and to assist the parents in educating their children in this area.
And we'll finish on this note then, Aileen. You mentioned there that it is only a proposed update, and I touched on this with Siobhan O'Higgins as well, that the suggestions now go out for public consultation, where teachers, parents and students and all other interested parties can have their say. I know the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment has engaged with the student voice and listened carefully to what students have to say, but also parents now, if they're concerned or any concerns that they may have, they can make a submission and get involved.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's 3 months for the consultation process, and that's with all the stakeholders, which obviously includes the parents, who play a very big part in this. And then I think the proposal is that after the 3 month consultation process, that the updated reforms to the curriculum would kick into gear in September of 2023, and that's my understanding of it with the junior cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. You can get more details on the NCCA website as well, or just by googling the changes to the SPHE or the RSE curriculum, and you'll get more details there. But thanks indeed to Aileen Hickey, CEO of Parentline, for joining us, and Dr. Siobhan O'Higgins a little bit earlier.
Kildare Today
with Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Message in on the WhatsApp. Can you please wish my Aunt Maureen Cross in Lullymore a very happy birthday? Hope you have a wonderful day from your newly ordained niece, Reverend Nicola. So thanks indeed for getting in touch with us. And Maureen Cross in Lullymore, I should say, have a great day and a very happy birthday to you. Now, moving on, and 1% levy should be put on construction output to contribute towards the costs of fixing thousands of Celtic Tiger era defective apartments, according to a group representing their owners. The call from the Construction Defects Alliance comes ahead of the publication of a major report on the extent of the problem of defective apartments carried out by an independent working group. Pat Montague is spokesperson for the Construction Defects Alliance, or the CDA as we've called them going forward. Pat, good morning and welcome to the programme.
Good morning, Owen, and good morning to your listeners.
Tell us about these calls that are coming from the CDA and the report that we're expected to see published shortly.
So, the report will show, as I understand it, that up to 100,000 apartments built between 1991 and 2013 are affected by serious defects, and in particular fire safety defects. So up to nearly 90,000 of those are affected by fire safety defects. And they arose basically because what's called fire stopping, which is meant to ensure that apartments because people in apartment developments are living on top of, below and beside each other, in much more close proximity than in normal housing estates, then in order to prevent fire and smoke spreading quickly from one to the other, they material that's called fire stopping is required in the under the floorboards, in the ceilings and in the walls dividing apartments from each other and from the common areas. Unfortunately, in up to 90,000 of those, which represents about 70% of the apartments built in that era, that fire stopping material was either not put in at all or put in so badly as to be totally ineffectual. So basically that's the issue in a nutshell, and it's going to cost somewhere between 1.7 and 2.8 billion to rectify those. Now, the principal reason why these defects arose, and the working group, as I understand it, will define the defects as breaches of the state's building regulations. The reason why they arose was because of that shoddy workmanship, and that's the principal reason. And because of that, that was the responsibility of the builder developers. It's interesting that in the UK recently, the major builder developers there have agreed, mind you, with a rather large gun to their heads, to one, rectify any defects in their own buildings, and two, then to contribute to a fund which would then be used to rectify defects in the buildings of where builder developers have gone bust.
Right.
So now we think a similar thing should apply here, that they should make a contribution, because frankly, it is principally their responsibility, and a significant number of those builder developers were A, bailed out by NAMA, and B, are in business again and are building, and there have been no consequences. And the people who have ended up picking up the tab are entirely innocent, i.e. the owners of those apartments.
So you're advocating for a 1% levy on construction output, so that would bring in, what, about 250 million?
Yeah, this year would bring in about 350, and obviously it's not going to be in this year, but next year it could certainly bring in about 400 million. And when you realise that the combined cost of the mica and apartment defects will come somewhere north of 7 billion. Over 10 years, a 1% levy on the construction sector could certainly bring in 4 or 5 billion and would go a long way to paying for both schemes. But the state also has a responsibility. I think this is important to say. The state does have a responsibility too. And the state's responsibility arises from the fact that their supervision, their monitoring, their enforcement of the building regulations was totally ineffectual. De facto, they've accepted that because they changed the enforcement mechanisms of the building regulations after Priory Hall was discovered, and those changes came into effect in 2014. But the state didn't ensure that the regulations were enforced. And unfortunately, we see it in so many other walks. We saw it previously with the banks, and that has now changed.
Right.
That unless there is active enforcement, unless there is active compliance building, then regulations will be ignored.
So up until now, Pat, and just to explain this for listeners maybe who are catching up on the story, have people been paying for these bills, footing these bills themselves?
Yes,
and if so, how much?
Yeah. So basically, the to date, the average is close enough to 20,000 per unit, and people have been paying those themselves. And you've raised a really important question, because at the moment, the working group estimates that up to 44,000 apartments, there are works either underway. These are works to fix fire safety defects, or works are being considered. And it's crucial from a safety point of view, that those works continue. And there's a real concern that the works will stop while people are waiting to see, because it's going to take time to put the full scheme in place, and that works will stop until then.
Is there a way of reimbursing people?
Pardon?
Is there a way of reimbursing people then? If
yes,
somebody
there is, and this really has come to point, in order to keep the works underway, then we need to see action in the budget in the form of a tax credit for owner-occupiers. Because at the moment, landlords can get tax relief on any levies they pay for fixing these defects. We need to make sure that owner-occupiers are sorted, and also too, because owner-occupiers make up about 25% of the owners of apartments, and also too, housing associations as well, because they are currently taking money from maintenance budgets, so monies that should be used to fix the homes of other social tenants to pay for these defects, and that's not fair or right. So we need to ensure that those works continue, and that's why we are asking for tax credits in this year's budget that would come into effect from the 1st of January, and they would help to make sure that works that are in hand continue, and that will help protect the safety of people living in fire defective apartments.
Okay, well, the publication of this major report, which is being commissioned by the Housing Minister, Dara O'Brien, due to be published shortly, found that fire safety, water ingress and structural issues are present in 80% of apartments built between 1991 and 2013. The Construction Defects Alliance advocating for the state and the construction sector to contribute towards remediation costs, which could require almost €3 billion to fix defects. And as Pat Montague said there, they're advocating for a 1% levy on construction output. Pat, we'll keep an eye on it, and as soon as that report is published, we'll reflect it here on the programme. But in the meantime, many thanks for joining us. That's Pat Montague.
Thank you all.
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie. Kildare
KFM. Now, just to let you know, Kildare County Council has today confirmed the appointment of Sonia Kavanagh as Chief Executive. Following a competitive interview process, Ms Kavanagh was recommended as the preferred candidate by the Public Appointment Service, and this recommendation was unanimously accepted by the elected members of Kildare County Council at a special meeting on Monday. So yesterday, Ms Kavanagh has held the position on an interim basis since September 2021. So Sonia Kavanagh has been confirmed as the new Chief Executive of Kildare County Council.
Yesterday we heard from SIP2, members employed by local authorities across this country, including here in Kildare. They're preparing to ballot for industrial action. This is, they say, a result of the failure of the government to conclude a deal on public sector pay that takes account of the increasing cost of living and high inflation rate. John King is the Deputy General Secretary of SIP2. He joins us this morning. How are you, John?
Yeah, good morning, thanks. Good morning to you and the listeners, yeah.
Reported in the Irish Independent today, ministers have said that they are denying refusing to talk as the public sector is set to ballot next month. What is your take on ministers' comments this morning?
Okay, well, so contextually, the Public Services Committee of the ICTU, including SIP2, we invoked the review clause of the current agreement because the pay terms were contained within that agreement have been completely eroded by inflation. And there is a clause in the current agreement that allows a review to take place. We done that on the 11th of March. It took us about 2 months to get into talks on that under the WRC. We went in on the 16th of March, early in the morning, and we left early the following morning on the 16th of June, and we left early the following morning on the 17th of June. And when we left on that day, not enough progress had been made, and the government side indicated that they needed time to reflect on their position.
And in terms of time, was there a limit given to that?
No. But here we are some 5 weeks later, and we're still not back in talks. And we understand that the government side are still reflecting. And we understand that that period of reflection is going to continue for another couple of weeks.
And how much reflection do you think is appropriate? Are you saying that a potential 7 weeks is too long?
Oh, it isn't. 7 weeks is beyond the pale in terms of the length of time that this should have taken. The reality of the situation is that there are experienced negotiators on the government side, on the Public Services Committee side, and with the expert facilitation services of the WRC, we could and should have been in a position to have been able to close out on an improved agreement well before now. I listened to the Minister's comments this morning with interest, and he indicates that the government side want to negotiate a settlement, but so do the Public Services Committee of Congress. He indicates that both sides need to move from their stated position. We have already confirmed that to the WRC and to the government side, that our position is completely negotiable.
Now, just in terms of your position, John, the government did make an offer, meaning public servants would receive increases worth a total of about 7% over the rest of 2022 and 2023. Is that correct?
Okay, so again, you have to look at this in the round. So I'm just going to ask you to give me a minute to do that. So the current agreement was concluded in late 2020 or early 2021. And it provided for a 1% pay increase on the 1st of October of 2021 for the year 2021. And when you annualise that over the year, that's a quarter of a percent. Contained within the current agreement is a 1% pay increase on the 1st of October for the year 2022, which is also, when you annualise it for the year, a quarter of a percentage increase. The government did make an improved offer in four phases, not as a straight off pay increase, and all of those pay increases would have been towards the latter end of this year and the latter end of next year. Now, the reality of the situation is that the pay rates of public servants have been completely eroded by the inflationary increases. When the current agreement was concluded, we were at practically zero inflation. There was uncertainty around the fiscal implications because of COVID on the exchequer. And what we do know is that since, thankfully, we've come out of those circumstances, that inflation, unfortunately, has gone through the roof. Thankfully, there was no long-term fiscal damage done to the economy. In fact, the opposite is the case. The economy and the fiscal situation has improved at a rate that wasn't even being predicted pre-COVID. So the only ones who aren't getting anything out of the current agreement are the workers who are covered by it. Now, the government side say that they know the existing terms need to improve. So there's a number of boxes that both the Public Services Committee side and the government side seem to be indicating, which is that, you know, that both sides want to negotiate a settlement, that both sides have to move from their positions, and that the existing terms need to improve. The only logical thing now that's not happening is that we're not talking to each other, because we haven't, or the government side haven't confirmed or haven't re-engaged with the WRC.
Now, John, the Dáil recess will be happening in the next couple of weeks, so that's going to impact the situation also. So you have said you're now left, and members of SIP2, that is, with no other alternative than to ballot. Now, the Fórsa General Secretary and the Irish Congress of Trade Unions President, that is Kevin Callanan, he has ruled out this industrial action will disrupt the budget.
So what's happening at the moment is that this is going to be a public services committee or a public service union-wide campaign. What SIP2 are going to be doing over the next 2 to 3 weeks is that we are going to be consulting with our members. All of the unions will be engaging in that consultation exercise, and we will be moving into a ballot phase, most likely towards the end of this month and into next month. And beyond that, if we then still don't have an agreement, well, then we will be moving to serve notice of intent to take industrial action and or strike action.
Have any government officials commented on this?
Have any government officials?
Yeah, comment on the fact that it's potentially, you know, after 5 week wait at the moment, they're reflecting on going into 7 weeks of Dáil recess, potentially this not being sorted out by the time they do take recess. Have they commented on the fact that people will be balloting?
The only one that I picked up on since we put out our press statement yesterday was the minister on the radio this morning. Certainly we do know after the talks broke down on the 17th of June that the Taoiseach, the Taoiseach and the minister himself all indicated the government desire to conclude an agreement, and that they recognise the benefits of an agreement, that it gives fiscal certainty, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So this comes back to the point that I'm making. Everybody seems to be indicating that they want an agreement, that a negotiated settlement is possible, that there is more money to give in the context of the current agreement. The difficulty we have is that we are not engaging under the auspices of the WRC, because we are being advised that the government side are needing time to reflect.
Okay.
And if we remain on this course, because since we were in the WRC on this, you know, when we broke up at 3 o'clock or 3:30 in the morning, whatever time it was.
Was the question asked though, John, how long is this time to reflect? Because if time is given to a government to reflect and there's no limit on that, then technically they can say, we can take as long as we want. It wasn't noted that it needs to be limited.
But then they're not operating within the spirit of the agreement, because the agreement provides under clause 5.7 that where the underlying assumptions of the agreement no longer apply, a review can take place. And the underlying assumption of the agreement was inflation at 0%. We now have inflation at north of 9%, and workers are struggling. And here's the reality. Workers don't cause inflation. Workers and their families are victims of inflation. And everybody on the government side seem to be indicating that they want an agreement, that an agreement is possible. And if that is the case, that's certainly the space the Public Service Committee of Congress want to be in, and therefore we should be engaging in talks at the WRC.
Okay, thank you for your time this morning. That is the Deputy General Secretary of SIPTU, John King, on the public service members of SIPTU preparing potentially for industrial action over pay.
Okay, we're going to go to the north of the county now, and an issue that was raised at the full council meeting yesterday by Fianna Fáil councillor Nisha O'Carroll of the Claimanuth Municipal District. And Nisha is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Owen.
You wanted the council to establish an emergency accommodation centre in the north of the county. Is there no such facility in place? Because you've the likes of Selbridge, Leixlip, Maynooth, Kilcock, very big towns in the county not being catered for in that respect.
Yeah, spot on, Owen. Look, there is a unit, or there are two units in Selbridge and in Prosperous that have some I suppose, capacity, but not a huge amount of capacity. The vast majority of emergency accommodation is in the south of the county. So you've Michael Garry House in Newbridge, you've Kurdistan House, you've Jigginstown Manor in Naas, you've a family hub in Athy, and then there's another area in Athy as well. So as you mentioned, you know, kind of the northeast of the county in particular, kind of is wanting of an emergency centre. And I suppose what I was getting at here as well is I have families that have been coming to me, I suppose over the past few months in particular, where landlords are selling the properties, and obviously then they need to vacate the properties. The problem is there's nowhere else to rent. So I just went on to Daft yesterday, for example. In Maynooth there was two properties available, €2,500 and one for €3,800. And then the other properties that are available in Selbridge, Leixlip and Kilcock were all one or two beds, which obviously wouldn't be suitable for families. So what that means is if a family is told they need to move out of a property, be it because a landlord is selling the property or if, say, a family member is moving in, they can't even find somewhere. So even if they are earning, let's say, a relative good salary, and they're just not finding somewhere to actually to rent. And what that has meant is that a lot of people are going into emergency accommodation, and because there's none up in the north of the county, they're going down into the likes of Newbridge. So two families, for example, from Maynooth that are in Newbridge at the moment with their kids in school in Maynooth, and obviously that commute up from Newbridge. Kildare is a big county, and it's quite a commute in the mornings. And I suppose what I'm getting at as well, it's a traumatic experience for anybody to experience homelessness, be it for one day, one week, one year, regardless.
you know, we should be trying to alleviate that trauma as much as possible. So,
and as we know, Nisha, those emergency accommodation centres that are in the likes of Naas, Newbridge and Athy are under serious pressure themselves. So does it run the risk that if a family becomes homeless in Selbridge, Leixlip or Kilcock or even Maynooth, that they would have to move into to Dublin to an emergency accommodation centre or into Meath to an emergency accommodation centre, for example?
And that's happening, Owen. That is happening. And it would be a case as well in other counties as well, in Dublin and Meath, for example. If there was, we'll say somebody became homeless, you know, on a Thursday evening, for example, and there was no available beds in, we'll say, like Navan, for example, and the closest place was, you know, Kildare, that is done. There's that kind of shared use of resources in the eastern region. But look, the council has said they acknowledge that there isn't adequate emergency accommodation in the north of the county. And the main thing is, obviously, look, the natural blocker, the cost of housing in the north of the county far exceeds that in the south of the county, but they are willing to look at, you know, any potential options. So what I would ask, Owen, if you'd indulge me, is that if any listeners, I suppose, or landlords have properties in the north of the county that would be suitable for such, I suppose, an endeavour in terms of emergency accommodation, please get in touch with either myself or indeed with the council, and we can look at it as an option.
Yeah, that was the final point I was going to put to you, Nisha, was did you have any, I suppose, centres or places in mind? Because dereliction is a huge problem here in the county, as we know, so I'm sure there are buildings that could facilitate this or house it.
Yeah, this, the good news is in the northeast of the county, there isn't much dereliction, to be honest. And what would usually be ideal for things like this would have been, we'll say, old convents or, we'll say, buildings that were used for, you know, kind of large buildings in central enough locations. So there's nowhere that springs to mind in Maynooth, but there might be in Leixlip, Selbridge, or closer, even in Kilcock as well. So, you know, if people can put the feelers out anyway, indeed if there are landlords listening, they might let us know. And just actually, while you have me on, I don't know if you heard the news, but Sonia Kavanagh, who is acting chief executive, has been appointed as the permanent chief executive of Kildare County Council. I'd just like to congratulate Sonia on her appointment. Obviously, as the outgoing Cathaoirleach, look, I spent a year working with Sonia and worked really, really closely. And I think it's great news for Kildare. I think it's great news for Kildare County Council, obviously. And she's one of her own. She's from Kildare, has worked in Kildare County Council for most of her adult life, and I think it's a really good news story.
Absolutely, well said. And that is Nisha O'Carroll, Fianna Fáil councillor on the Clane Maynooth Municipal District. And as Nisha mentioned, if there is anyone listening, be it landlords or people in the areas of Leixlip, Kilcock, Maynooth or Selbridge that have any ideas of where possible emergency accommodation centres could be housed, then do get in touch with either Nisha O'Carroll himself, Kildare County Council, or if you get in touch with us here at KFM, we can pass the message on.